Welcome. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. And Paradigm Shifters are just a series of interviews by me, Veronica Entwistle, bringing to you people that are making a difference in our species at this time on the planet. And we've talked to so many different kinds of people, inventors and performers and scientists of all kinds and futurists and who knows. But today I have a much beloved, actually relative, and she is an amazing performer. I'm so proud and honored to be presenting to you Jane Entwistle, who is star of stage and screen and commercials and tons of improv and is quite well known out in the audiobook circuit. Jane Entwistle, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you. I don't think we've done one of these for a lot of years. 2008, I think it was, when were talking about we were talking about improv, and I believe at that time you had a weekly improv show that you'd set up on Friday nights in San Francisco. It was a very bold move for a young starlet, right?
Yes. Scary.
And you Yeah, but you did it, I think, for 7 years or something, didn't you?
Yeah, I did it. Yeah, almost 10, actually. I think almost 10 years.
It was very, very expanding. But one of the things about Jane that I should say is she also has a master's degree in drama therapy and counseling psychology. And I love the connection between, for example, improv and counseling and drama therapy. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that? I thought it was just for fun and pleasure, but really it's not, is it?
No. And just to clarify, I have a master's degree in counseling psychology, and my specialization was somatic psychotherapy, which is the mind-body connection. Drama therapy was something that I wrote my thesis on, and but so I just wanted to clarify that.
I'm glad you did. And without getting into the somatic stuff, I'd love you to talk a bit more about the drama therapy and its link with improv. Actually, maybe the body therapy also would link with improv, but you'd have to edify me on that.
Well, sure. And I think it actually all relates, because even as an actress, I'm a physical actress. I like to change up my body, my posture, my face, my accent. And when I teach improv and I teach actors how to do different characters, I approach it from actually sort of a somatic viewpoint, where I teach them to really go into their bodies. And one of the exercises we do is I have them walk around the room sort of in a neutral way, you know, as themselves, really. And then I'll call out something, like I'll say, I want you now to embody a character who leads through life with their chin. So put all of your energy into your chin. And what kind of a person, what kind of a character leads through life with their chin? I'm sure you can sort of visualize it. And so I'll have them, and for some students, it's very, very difficult because they're not really connected to their bodies. They're sort of a cerebral actor. They don't really come alive from the shoulders down. So it's more challenging for them, but I try and encourage everyone to experiment with it. And when you start putting all of the energy into your chin and you kind of thrust it out, so it's the first thing that enters the room, the whole rest of your body has to change. You can no longer be yourself, because that's not how you're oriented in the world. And so everything changes. The way you talk changes, because now your chin is sort of jutting out and it affects your voice. The shape of your face will slightly change. The way you carry yourself changes. So this is one of the ways I encourage my actors to explore finding ways to find new characters. Or I'll say, imagine that your chest is kind of sunken. You know, what kind of a person has a sunken chest? And I immediately think of someone who is feeling defeated. You know, someone who's sort of caved in around the heart area and the lungs. So that then I can link back to my studies of somatic psychology, where we studied the connection between the body and the mind, and that they're not separate. And that if you're addressing emotional, mental issues, you have to address how those issues correlate with the body. Because if the body is holding on, and you certainly know this in your work, if the body is holding on to, you know, an ancient pain or resentment or abuse, the body is not always going to be so willing to just hand that over, because that's how the body has oriented itself. So then,
so it fights for its safety.
That's how I link improv to my studies of psychology. Mm. Yeah,
wow,
well, I remember
that's really interesting.
When I was doing my studies, I encountered out in the field at in a counseling situation, a little boy who had, he was only about two, I think, and he had been physically abused, and his shoulders came very high up around his ears all the time. That's how his shoulders had learned to orient themselves. And if you think about someone who's warding off blows to the head, your shoulders are going to come up as a protective measure to ward off the blows. And his shoulders had already sort of settled into that position of being really high up around his ears. So if you fast forward to when that child becomes an adult and say is in, you know, psychotherapy situation, and those shoulders have always remained up there as a defense mechanism, you can't, you're going to need to address those shoulders at some point, that it's okay. Mm-hmm. It's going to be okay for those shoulders to finally release their defense. Anyway, I think that stuff is, I find that fascinating. And I love correlating that to my acting.
So back to the fellow whose shoulders are way up there, Janie, if you're helping him go act out a part which would require his shoulders to be different, this is a funny question, but would that release him psychologically in his own makeup as well?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I think he'd probably have to be aware of the role those shoulders have played and what those shoulders mean to him. I don't know that just taking on a role where their shoulders are not high up around, you know, not sort of up in that defensive position, I don't know that that would be enough. But I think with the right intention and focus and support, that could definitely be a way to get to address the issue, not solve the issue by any stretch. But in drama therapy, you know, using drama as a tool to discover ourselves is very powerful. And I used it in the past when I was doing work with children who were severely emotionally disturbed, is the term they have been termed with. I used improv as a way to, I'm not sure if we talked about this before, but I would use improv to sort of reenact situations in which they could try and gain back some control of, say, if they're in an argument and their impulse is to punch, doing improv and reenactment to find out how we can slow down that scenario to try and stop the impulse to punch and instead become more emotionally aware and find alternate ways to, you know, to deal with our anger rather than just punching.
So could we really take that into the Congress?
I know we talked about that before. I mean, that would be fantastic. I think improv could be everywhere. It's certainly they're certainly using it a lot more than ever before in dealing with in the corporate world. I mean, it's always been kind of in the corporate world, but it is just expanding.
Really?
I know lots of teams that are working not just for team building, but for all kinds of situations, for problem solving, for, how to deal with employees,
Or
expressing their
coming up with
issues.
creative answers or creative solutions for problems, yeah?
Creative solutions,
Yeah, because
effective communication. Yeah.
I remember you talking, and that was a long time ago, so I don't mind repeating it, but you were talking about the Hadron Collider and how the physicists that came from all over the world to create that they used improv to help themselves resolve issues, right?
Well, initially the improv teacher from Chicago was brought to help them field questions because the whole world was watching. And they would have to field questions, answer off the cuff, deal with the media, deal with the focus of the world on them, how to handle that. And so improv was brought in as a way to give them tools to be more spontaneous, to think more, improvisationally. And they realized that it had larger positive effects. They were finding that it helped them be better communicators in their meetings, in their research meetings. And then they even took to it so much that they created a little improv team and ended up performing for their community when everyone came together to see this momentous historic moment of the atom being split. So,
Wow. Isn't that made up metaphorical? Is that splitting all these dissensions and splitting all these little fiefdoms so that they could become a greater unity, right? There's kind of a
Well,
parallel there, isn't there?
it's an amazing metaphor for life, and the fact that improv was at its core just makes me sing. Makes me so proud
Yeah,
to
I
be an
think that's
improviser.
brilliant. Wow, and talk about proud. I'm proud to be your stepmother. I'm saying that over global radio. But when I first met Jane, you were what, 12, I think, okay? And all you wanted to be was an actor. And I didn't really know you, and I didn't know how creative you were, but I went, oh Lord, that's going to be a hard job. And I would like you to talk to people about who you are and how early you became an actor in your own dream and so on. Would you like to talk a bit about yourself, Janie?
Sure. Well, I think that I was always an actor. I know from family members that I was performing from when I was very, very little. I would entertain the family, I would entertain the public. I would, in England, where I'm from, I would dance on the beach and cover myself in sand and do shows. I don't know why I was covered in sand, but I guess it was part of my act. And you and I did some performing when we were in Israel. I made you dress up and we performed to the song Flash Gordon by Queen. So I was always performing, but I was always being told to, settle down, don't act up, don't act out. Being British was, be children are to be seen, not heard. To be polite. And so it wasn't until I was in grade 8 in Canada, where you and I met in Canada, when somebody encouraged me in junior high school where
Janie is a
grades.
well-traveled young woman.
I am a citizen of the world. I was encouraged by a fellow
TikTok.
student to take drama because there was no homework and you didn't even have to sit at a desk. And I didn't even know what drama really was, but I knew that if I got to sit on the floor and not do homework, I was in. So I took drama and I remember sitting on the oh, and someone had said we actually played Duck Duck Goose in class. And I don't even think I knew what Duck Duck Goose was. So I remember the first day of class, we were sitting in a circle on the carpet, and the teacher came in and she had shocking red hair. And I have red hair. It's not shockingly red like Miss Smith's was, but I have red hair nonetheless. And she came in with the shocking red hair, and I immediately perked up. Oh. And then we played Duck Duck Goose. And then, which I thought was hilarious. And then we got into, drama, and it was like somebody had turned the light on. It was
Oh.
it can make me want to cry even now. It was somebody saying to me, it's okay to actually act up and act out. It was so li it
Oh.
was so liberating and eye-opening. And then that was it. That was the start of my acting, my real acting, that had a name for it, not just me being a goofball. And I had done plays before that. I did a play at summer camp, and which was when I was younger than that, and I loved it. But now I have been given permission, and I have been given a guidebook, as it were. And then I never stopped. Come hell or high water, I was going to be an actor. I went to school for it. I went to university for it. Unfortunately, my lovely father wanted me to be more pragmatic and insisted I major in English lit and minor in theater. But it's okay because the English lit has helped me throughout my life and in graduate school. And then the theater just reaffirmed who I really was.
But you are also a tremendous writer, and I knew that when I first knew you, and you were so young. You're a tremendous writer. So I can see the orientation to that as well, hey?
Oh yeah, that the English literature definitely helped me. The writing, the creative writing, the study of poetry, the study of, some of the great writers throughout history, it definitely helped me. But so here's an interesting thing I wanted to bring up. I, like many people, I think, suffer dreadfully from imposter syndrome. I don't know if you
Oh,
do. And
I can, but not very often.
it's a really curious thing. And when I look at my schooling, when it comes to writing and English and all of that, I feel well, what's the word? Well seasoned, well educated. I feel good about that. But because I only got a minor in theater, I feel like an imposter when it comes to acting because I don't feel like I deserve to be there because I didn't get the full Monty when it came to training. Same with improv. I
Wow,
know, it's
really?
ridiculous. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Well, I don't know if it's
And I.
ridiculous, but I sure know there's two kinds of people. Some of them have never taken a course in their lives and they're great at it, and I can't think of a name right now. So, yeah, it's a big stress for you.
Well, there are people who are naturally brilliant at things that have not ever taken a course or studied. But there are also a lot of people, politics being a big one, and even acting, where there are people in high-ranking positions getting paid a lot of money, and they certainly deserve the title of imposter because they don't know what they don't actually know what they're doing, but people are just throwing money at them anyway. So here I am. I'm actually a skilled improviser, even though I don't have any formal training. And yet I feel like an absolute, and I've taught it, I've directed it, I've performed it, I've won awards in it, I've traveled with it, and yet I will always probably feel like an imposter because of some bizarre societal comparison I'm making.
About training, you mean?
Yeah, what I deserve and don't deserve. It's one of the things about myself I like least, but it's there, and it's, you know, I just thought I'd be honest about it.
I thought it was really interesting when you started your improv troupe in San Francisco. You were quite young, and I'm referring to the imposter thing again. And there you were right downtown San Francisco on Friday nights with very little support. And remember, you were doing your stuff over and over again, and you grew your crowds. That's not an imposter. That's an entertainer. That's someone who brings it open to people. Doesn't improv open people to themselves?
I think so, absolutely. I
watched a number of people. Go ahead.
Well, because you're drawing, when we're improvising, we are drawing from within our scripts, the things we're saying, because there are no scripts, you know, the things we're saying, the things we're imagining, the characters we're creating, we're drawing from, from ourselves. I mean, I'm not saying when you're doing acting with a script that you're not, but when the words are generated wholly from within ourselves, that is coming from someplace. And I think that, you know, for most part, we're using improv to be silly and goofy. But I think I maybe talked about this before, but I was doing an improv show, and it was improvised to Agatha Christie. And I was playing the Miss Marple-esque character. Her name was Dorothea Stack. And, you know, we would do the improv show. We were in costumes. We had Cole Porter music. We had a set. But the entire show is improvised. And we would get from the audience, you know, why are these 10 people gathered? And who is going to die? And that's it. That's all we'd get. And where are they? So, you know, they're in the pyramids of Egypt to read the will of Sir Monty, and Catherine the Maid is going to die. That's all we'd know. Then we would build this whole two-act show around it. And at the end, I would have to summarize how all these people, I would have to summarize who killed the maid and why, based on everything that had been said. And it meant keeping track of lots of details. And anyway, I was petrified. Opening night, I rang the director. I said, I can't possibly come. I'm sick. I'm in bed. He said, great. See you at 7. And so I showed up. And as soon as I stepped on stage as Dorothy Stack, something took over. And I was amazed watching Dorothea handle all this information and then deliver this motive and the means and wherefores of how this murder happened. And I would be perplexed because I, Jane, could never figure that out. I don't know how Dorothea did it. And I don't know where that comes from. So it came from me, obviously, because I was Dorothea. But at the same time, I wasn't Dorothea. Dorothea was smarter than me. She had a better memory than I do. She was more attentive to details than I am. I mean, that really interests me. So talk about opening us up.
And you also went through college. You went through your psychology courses having to get to know yourself and work with a lot of your own issues, didn't you? That's part of the course, is it not?
Yeah, I went to a holistic school, so their philosophy was that we learn basically from the inside out. You know, we studied theories and philosophies. We studied all kinds of things. We read books, obviously, but we had to take the information, digest it as it were, and then see how it related to us and look internally for our own, you know, how we related to the issues, and then express that in group therapy. So for instance, we did a whole class on eating disorders. So we had to keep a food journal. We had to track everything we ate and how we felt when we ate it. I remember an exercise where we were blindfolded and a partner in the class had to feed us. And I hated it. Because I'm very squeamish about what I eat. I'm a fussy eater in some ways. And being blindfolded and being fed was horrifying to me. It made me panicky. I felt desperate. I felt out of control completely. And the point of the exercise was discovering how our need to control our food and sort of be in charge of it has an emotional implication, and how that feels when we're not in control. And you know, it was very illuminating to me. And so
did you change anything as a result of that?
I think just an awareness. I find myself sometimes asking, why am I eating this right now? Or if I'm upset and suddenly want something or craving something, wondering, am I craving this chocolate because I'm really upset and I feel like I need to be comforted? And I'll often will eat that chocolate, but I think, and I'm not, and please don't get me wrong and think that I have all this sorted out and that, you know, because I don't. And only sometimes do I ask, why am I eating this? And sometimes I eat stuff without asking, and I probably shouldn't even be eating that thing. So it helped me in that way.
Sounds like you're like the rest of us. So talk about this part of it that fascinates me. And I mentioned it to you at the beginning before we first started recording, that you are so excellent with all of these different, like you've sought through yourself to see who you are, what are your blocks and how to grow it and so on. But then you're performing all these different characters. And like you said, with Ms. Marple, whatever her name is, I think that's the right name.
Dorothea
that
Stack.
Dorothea Stack, it just runs through you and it gets through you. And I sort of marvel and I go, well, does it help? Well, let me see. I'm trying to figure out, does it mean that you kind of channel are going in and out of all these different identities? Are you many personality characters, or you've got more flexibility in personality because you know your own better? Or is it just like an exploration of what people are really like all over the place?
I think it's a little of
identity.
All of the above. I feel every actor is different and they have a different approach. I've never been very good at sitting down with my script and really analyzing it and writing. You know, I know friends who will write all kinds of things all over their script, you know, analyzing sentence structure and motivations. And I find that I don't know if this is me being lazy or if it's just my approach, but I find that I feel my way into characters more than being very analytical. I don't take so much a cerebral approach as a more kind of intuitive and emotional approach.
And a being rather than...
Yeah, a being. And sometimes a definite channeling, but not always. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it can mm-hmm. be hard when I don't feel the character. If my style of acting is to feel my way into the characters, what am I supposed to do when I don't feel a character? You know, then it becomes a
And what do you
trickier.
Do if that happens? Surely that's happened at times, has it?
Oh, yeah, it's happened.
And then what do? Are you frozen then?
No, then I'm more acting the part than being the part.
Mm.
I'm using, you know, now I don't really know how to explain the difference there. I feel
Can you
like
tell the difference when you're watching other acting?
Yeah. Well, there's actors.
Mm-hmm.
There's actors who are basically just themselves. They get paid a lot of money to just be themselves, no matter what character they're playing. They don't change at all. They sound the same. They walk the same. They act the same, no matter what the character is from movie to movie.
You mean like John Wayne? You mean like John Wayne?
I know John Wayne. But John Wayne wasn't John Wayne sort of a caricature in and of himself? Wasn't the
yes.
John Wayne character? Right. So that is a little bit different because I feel like, I don't know what John Wayne was like, you know, when he was at home, but I don't know if he was swaggering around his house at home saying, I'm going to get me another cup of coffee or whatever he did. but I'm thinking more modern, you know. I don't really want to say any names on the radio and get myself ostracized, but I can think of a whole lot of characters who it's like, oh, yeah, there's so-and-so playing himself in yet another movie. But hey. And making a fortune. But you know, that works for that person, and the audience
mm-hmm.
likes it. Otherwise, that person would not continue to make movies. So
mm-hmm.
that's not my style, but I can't really fault that.
I'm going to mention a person that I really admire. So I'm going to mention a name, and if you think we should delete it, we will. But I think of Meryl Streep as being able to go in and out of characters. What do you think of that?
Oh, she's amazing. Oh, my goodness. She is fantastic. I curtsy to that woman. Okay, for example, I can't remember the name of it. I just watched a fantastic movie about, it's going to be a spoiler. So I won't say it. I'm just going to say that she changes everything. She will wear different teeth, you know, so that her voice structure is different, or the teeth change the way her face looks. She's phenomenal. She is a person who physically transforms into her role.
Hmm.
And I admire that.
And that's
very
Meryl
much.
Streep.
Mm. Yeah, Meryl Streep.
Wow.
Well,
but it's a never end.
I recently saw a movie that she was in, and I didn't even realize she was playing one of the characters because she had transformed so much. I didn't even know it was her.
Oh, wow.
That's
really?
How good she is.
Wow.
Yeah. And she
played
a different character. Yeah. And she played a different character in the movie. And you knew it was Meryl Streep playing this character. But she played two characters in this movie. And I had no idea it was her. And when it was revealed, I was so envious. Oh, that excites me. I want that opportunity.
I heard a podcast of you being Judi Dench. That was that fun for you?
Oh, so much fun. Because I adore Judi Dench. I think she is a remarkable actress. a very interesting lady, and it was a real honor to portray her in this podcast. Yeah.
And did you didn't know much about her, but what happens is you got right into how I would expect her to feel and be. I found that even though it's a short podcast, I found it quite remarkable.
Oh, well, that is very encouraging. I only researched a few facts about her life. But, you know, the rest was improv. The whole podcast was improv. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to honor her, and I have no idea how she would answer the questions I was asked, but I'm really encouraged to hear that you felt they would be similar.
Yeah, and I felt like she would be honored, actually. And, oh, so I want to say there's another thing, too, is that when you're performing these other people, there is kind of a growth and a healing in you, isn't there? Like Meryl Streep must feel that a lot, hey? You grow and you heal when you're doing that.
I think so. I think that there's both a growth and a healing, but there is also not a danger, but there's also a precarious flip side of that. I'll give you an example. I did a movie several years ago. We filmed in New Mexico, and it was a thriller. And Danny Trejo is in it. He's an actor. And I was playing the mother of a serial killer. And when I I know, not a movie that you personally would want to see. And I remember asking the director, well, it doesn't explain in the script why the son is killing these high school girls. And he said, I want people to leave the theater and ask the same question and then answer it with, well, did you see his mother? So he said, you're the reason that he's killing these girls. Go figure it out. So I immediately returned in my mind to my psychotherapy days and wondered what would cause a son, what kind of relationship would that mother and son have to have in order for the son to do those violent things? That was a really interesting process for me. And then
what's
when
the
I was
answer,
in my,
Janie?
Well, the answer I came up with, and I am in no way saying this is clinically correct. You know, if a psychiatrist were to weigh in, I don't know what they would say. But in my mind, what I came up with was that the mother herself had a real distortion, obviously, that came from her past. And that the mother and son were completely enmeshed, you know, that there was no real separation between the mother and son, mm-hmm. that she had kind of engulfed the son, if that makes any sense. And
it's scary. It's scary.
And that his, oh yeah. And that's what I came up with. And that he had a kind of a strange love rage relationship with his mom. And when I was trying to find this character, this mother, trying to sort of lock her into my own self, I had worn a knitted shawl to the audition that the director really liked and said he wanted to use in the movie. So I was at home and I had the shawl and I put on some house slippers and I stood in front of the, I can't remember if I stood in front of the mirror or not, but I remember just trying to sort of find her in my body, thinking about the son, thinking about this awful history they had, thinking about the things that he was going to do. And the first thing I did is I kind of sunk my chest in this, you know, I talked earlier about defeat, you know, and then I made my jaw really, really slack. So it kind of always was slightly open and really slack instead of holding any tension in my jaw, which then kind of pulled the energy down and made my face feel really droopy. My eyes felt really droopy. Hmm. All the energy kind of in my face, like there was, like I wasn't holding any tension in my face at all, just slack. And every time I would take that position, I'd start to retch.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Mm-hmm. And how did you interpret that? Was that hatred or deep abuse or what?
I have no idea. I honestly have no idea. I don't know what that means. But I'll tell you this, mm-hmm. if in 20 years they came to me and said, the movie was never released, by the way, which is really disappointing to me. But if they came to me in 20 years and said, we're going to make a sequel or we're going to release a movie and we need some, you know, footage, and I had to find that character again, I could find her in a heartbeat. Because all I know I'd have to do is slacken my jaw and sink my chest, you know, cave my chest in, and she's there. Oh, she is there. So that's really interesting, but it's also kind of scary. What does that mean?
Yeah, really.
And I still retch when I do it.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Tell people where it is you want it, because I know we're going to have to end this fairly soon, although I could sit and listen forever. But what is it you want to do with all of this amazing talent you've got? This is an amazing talent. And if you start walking funny when you're around me, I'll have to really look at you and say, uh-oh, what's she picking up on me? But what is it you want to be in the next phase of your amazing career, which is a really exciting, I didn't tell people, you've been doing so many audiobooks and you're quite well known in the audiobook field, and you've got your commercials and a whole bunch of things that you've done and all your performances on stage. My goodness, Janie, where do you want to keep going to?
I want more, more, more. First of all, say that. You know, being British, I really, really want to go home and work over there. And I am going for a month in January to start that ball rolling. I watch so much British television. And I'm almost obsessed with it. And I think it's because that is where I'm from. That is how I feel in my heart. And so when I watch the British television, I feel really connected to, you know, who I am, where I came from. And I just ache to be on those shows. So that is, that's something that I really, really, really want to make happen. And I also want to be given the opportunity to show, I don't feel like I've been able to show how far I can go emotionally in a role. You know, I don't feel that I've gotten to really express that or show that. And I really want that opportunity.
Will that be a horror show, or that, or will it be a happily ever
more
after
drama,
show, or both?
More, not horror. I mean, more. I don't feel as though I've had the opportunity yet to delve into a character and remain there for a long period of time, meaning the duration of a movie. I mean, except for Janice Rooker, who I played in the horror movie. You know, I did feel that I got a taste of that. That was a long time ago, though. So I really want that opportunity. I want to show.
I had a close friend who told me she played Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire, and it took her months to recover and come out of that. Does that sort of make sense to you?
Oh, yeah. I can believe that. Absolutely. Well, I remember back a long time ago when we were living in Arizona, you and I, and I was in a theater company there. I did Marat Saad, which is a shortened version of the play, has a very long title. I can't think of what the whole title is.
I can't remember
the
whole thing
play.
Either.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's like The Persecution and something of Jean-Paul Marat. And it's, and I played Marat Saad's, no, Jean-Paul Marat and the Marquis de Sade. That's who the play is about. I played Jean-Paul Marat's girlfriend, and we were in an insane asylum. And she had a palsy in her hand. I don't know if you remember this. So my hand,
I do.
Which was held up to my chest, had to constantly mm-hmm. shake quite, you
I'd
know,
forgotten
quite
that. That was a really amazing experience to watch. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And that, you know, we were all in an insane asylum, and all the other actors in it were insane asylum members. And it took me a while to make my hand not shake, to not be in that. It was such a, what's the word?
I don't know, but
I
you're
mean,
really
talk,
being
talk
a gestalt. It's like a gestalt. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, gestalt. I really was rolling around in that energy of that insane asylum. And it was hard to shake that off. And I'm not the only one. The London production company who did that very same play, they all, and they, you know, in London on the West End, they do the show something like 7 times a week for, you know, months on end. And after the show, they all had to go, they weren't committed, but they all, the cast had to go and sort of go into a soft form of rehab.
Wow. Well, that makes
yes.
sense. That makes sense. Because you have to be yeah. in it. And we all have some of that in us all the time. Well, Jane Entwistle, this has been very inspiring for me. And I'm so grateful that you could share with people what it's like paradigm shifting for people's minds and hearts through the theater. Wonderful.
Well, I'm very honored to be interviewed by you on your podcast, and humbled at the thought of even being, you know, remotely next to a paradigm shifter. So thank you.
Well, I hope you'll come back, because you're going to be pushing through some more frontiers. I know that, and we want to hear about it. So, and how can people get hold of you or pay attention to what it is you're doing? Do you have some podcasts, or do you have some a website that people can check into, find out what you're up to?
I do. My website is The Jane, J-A-Y-N-E, thejaneshow.net. And my Twitter is The Jane Show, at The Jane Show.
Nice.
Again, J-A-Y-N-E.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you so much for spending this time with us and inspiring. You inspired me, and I'm sure listeners are going to say the same thing. So I thank you so much for all you do, Jane. Keep on growing, keep on glowing, and thank you again. All right.